Iran warns Israel of a harsh response to any act of aggression against the Islamic Republic. The Taliban militants capture the second provincial capital in less than 24 hours in fighting with the Afghan government forces. And Russia reports more than 22,000 new daily COVID-19 cases and over 790 deaths. Hello from Tehran. You've tuned into World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us right here to Iran, where a senior Iranian commander has warned of a harsh response to any act of aggression amid U.S. and Israeli threats against the country.
We possess both the power and the resolve to wield that power. We will certainly give a tough response. They cannot commit any foolishness.
Haji Zadeh said Iran has already passed its test and the country's enemies are aware of the kind of response that they would get. However, he said the enemies are free to try Iran again at their own peril. Israel and its Western allies have accused Tehran of a deadly attack on an Israeli-managed tanker off of Oman without providing any substantial evidence. The U.S. has even promised to lead a collective response while Israel has vowed military action. Iran has dismissed the allegations as part of a Western psychological warfare meant to pave the way for new adventurism in the region. Well, Iraq's al-Nujaba resistance movement has voiced its readiness to support Lebanon's Hezbollah in its standoff with the Israeli regime. In a statement, the movement said it is fully prepared to play a role in Hezbollah's equation of deterrence against the Zionist regime. The movement hailed Hezbollah's firing of rockets into Israel on Friday in response to airstrikes by the regime. Al-Nujaba said the retaliation showed the occupiers are on the decline. The statement also criticized the negligence and inaction of some regional countries in the face of, quote, aggressive approach of American and Israeli occupiers. Al-Nujaba underlined that resistance fighters are present on every battlefield to deal blows to what it says occupying thugs. Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip have welcomed Hezbollah's rocket attacks on Israel in response to Israeli airstrikes. They also stressed on maintaining their unity in the face of Israeli crimes in the region. And now it's time for our news review. The Palestinian ambassador to the UN has condemned the international community's inaction on what he called Israeli regime's grave crimes against Palestinians. Riyad Mansour made this statement in separate letters to the United Nations Secretary General, as well as the heads of the UN Security Council and the General Assembly. He said the international community remains quiet on the killing of innocent Palestinians despite repetitive calls from several nations and governments. Mansour urged the UN to hold Israel accountable for the killing of Palestinians, adding that the lack of punishment has emboldened the regime to continue its atrocities in the occupied territories. He noted that the aggression of Israeli settlers and forces have reached an unprecedented level, leading to the death of many Palestinians and the confiscation of their property. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. Out of Ramallah, Mona Candil, and out of Edinburgh, Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off with Mona. Now, Mona, fill us in the latest. We've heard what the Palestinian ambassador to the UN has said about basically the lack of any action by the so-called international community.
Well, in a letter that was sent by Palestine's envoy to the United Nations, Dr. Riyad Mansour, he sent the three similar letters to the UN Secretary General, as well as to UN General Assembly President and UN Secretary Council President. In his message or letters, he said that the world is witnessing the serious crimes committed by Israel, including the killing of its children, of women, of innocent men, and they are doing nothing while still paralyzed. On Friday, Palestinians were demonstrating against Israeli settlements in the village of Beita near Nablus, mainly this protest took place at the Sabih mountain, where Israeli settlers have erected an illegal settlement. They left it. However, the Israeli forces are still stationing at the mountain, protecting some buildings there. Palestinians are angry. They want to get back their land. The protest was a peaceful demonstration. Israeli forces used live ammunition against the protesters, killing an innocent Palestinian, 38 Palestinian man, Imad Al-Wikat, father of five, and wounding 40 others. The Israeli soldiers killed him in cold blood. In these protests in Beita, six Palestinians were shot dead. They did nothing. They were taking part in peaceful protests, including a number of children. So the Palestinian leadership and the Palestine's envoy is addressing the word that what they else want for Israel to do in order to start acting on the ground, because their silence is definitely encouraging the Israeli regime to continue committing its aggressive practices, its a crime, killing in cold blood the people of Palestine. So Riyad Mansour and all the Palestinians are demanding the protection of the Palestinian people at a time. They must be speaking about ending the Israeli occupation, not demanding the Israeli regime to stop its crimes.
What about that, Mick? I mean, the silence is deafening, as Mona has just talked about the silence. When we look at the situation, and of course, Mr. Mansour talked about how emboldened now the Israeli regime is becoming more and more. And we look at this. I mean, 60 years of more than 60 years of dealing with this. And now, Mick, even it's filmed. We see, especially every Friday, we see the Palestinians trying to protest. And at least one person, at least one, is killed every Friday. Unfortunately, many more. I mean, this has been going on for decades now with video footage, and nothing is happening. Mick, what is it going to take for Palestinian lives to matter to the United Nations?
It's very difficult to add anything to what Mona Candil has said and what you've said yourself. It's not a subtle situation. It's not a shades of grey. It's relentless violence by the Zionist occupation authorities against unarmed Palestinians who demand their human and their national rights, who ask that they not be dispossessed, that their land not be stolen or taken away violently, and in return they are met with endless violence. That's been going on, you say, 60 years. Actually, it's built into the history of Israel. Because given that the goal of the Zionist project is to take over the whole of Palestine and beyond, but the whole of Palestine for the moment, with no Palestinians or very few, then it has to be accompanied by violence. You cannot play music and the Palestinians will leave. It can only be done by killing, and that killing has to come in a creative ways. Look. One example I know, because I spoke to the father many years ago when I went to Gaza, the only time I went there, was the case of Iman al-Hams. And we only know the case because by accident the conversations were recorded. Look, one officer murdered a 13-year-old girl. When he wasn't sure she was dead, he went over to her and emptied a magazine into her inert body to confirm the kill. He was charged, because of the publicity, he was charged by the Israeli army with unethical conduct, and he was found not guilty. It is not unethical in the Israeli army for a group of soldiers to kill a 13-year-old Palestinian schoolgirl And that's the reality. From time to time, we see videos of what's happening. But we all know that when Palestinians carried out the Great March of Return, they were slaughtered in very, very large numbers by snipers who rarely ever sustained a scratch. Look, my government, the British government, as an example, has an intelligence agency. They have offices in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. They know exactly what's going on. And I have to say, they don't remain quiet. They support Israel. Whenever the Palestinians resist, as they recently, when rockets came from Gaza in order to try to protect the Al-Aqsa Mosque, my government says Israel is protecting itself. So when Israel commits grotesque crimes, these governments say this is Israel protecting itself. And the UN, of course, is paralyzed by the US, the French, and the British veto, which gives Israel this sense of complete impunity. So that's the situation. Mm-hmm. Palestinians can rely on no one except themselves and governments who resist American domination of the region, and people around the world like the dockers who turn away Israeli ships in protest at Israeli crimes. But Okay. Yes, you've said it. It's very difficult to add anything to that to that description. It is relentless, week after week, killing of people who demand that they be treated equal to Jews in a system based on Jewish supremacy and the built-in inferiority in the political system of Muslims and Christians. Everything follows from that, and there's no end in sight until the Zionist project is defeated. And that means militarily defeated, politically defeated.
Stay with me, let me get Mona back in on this. Mona, as a Palestinian, and I mean, we're talking about this, and we talk about decades after decades after decades of this. Tell me about the Palestinian psyche, the young people and the old people who've experienced this time and time again. Overall mentality, just bring us up to par on that. I think a lot of times we don't really talk about the overall effect of this type of continual oppression on the Palestinian people.
Well, several human rights organizations have said that these Israeli crimes could be seen as an attempt to prevent people from taking part in demonstrations, for example, to terrify others not to take part in protests and to send clear messages to the families of or the parents of the children and teenagers who take part in peaceful demonstrations, that if anyone would be taking part in such a protest, he would be simply shot and killed, if not killed, would be seriously wounded. The ongoing arrest campaigns that continue to take place on a daily basis is in the first place to terrify the children, Palestinians, and to keep reminding the Palestinians that they are living under the Israeli occupation, that they are not allowed to defend their lands, to defend their rights, or even to defend themselves. However, Palestinians today, regardless and despite of all these crimes and aggression, they continue to take part in anti-Israel activities, protests, demonstrations. Activists throw rocks at the Israeli forces, whatever they can do to be engaged in different forms of resistance. This did not stop because they believe that this is the least they can do in order to fight the Israeli occupation and in order to bring this Israeli occupation to an end.
All right, thanks so much, both of you, for being with us on this news review. That's Mona Kendil out of Ramallah. And out of Edinburgh, Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. And thank you for being with us for another news review. Well, the Taliban have captured the second Afghan provincial capital in less than 24 hours. The militant group is now in control of Sherbagan, the capital of Jozjan province in the north. The Jonestown deputy governor says government forces and officials have retreated to the city's airport. On Friday, the city of Zaranj in Nimruz, it became the first provincial capital to fall into the hands of the militants. Its deputy governor said the militants overran the city without a fight. The group has already seized dozens of districts and border crossings in recent weeks and now battling for several key cities, including Herat and Kandahar. The Taliban has intensified their offensive following the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces. Moving on to other news now this hour, turn to Russia, where the COVID-19 pandemic continues to take its toll as the country has reported more infections and related deaths. Health officials registered over 22,000 new daily cases, raising the national tally to over 6.4 million. Over 790 more people also died from the respiratory disease during the last 24 hours, pushing the total fatalities to over 164,000. Authorities blamed the surge on a more contagious Delta variant. Russia was the first country to authorize a coronavirus vaccine, but the process is too slow amid public reluctance to get vaccinated. Only 26% of the Russian population has been vaccinated with at least one dose so far. And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The federal minimum wage has remained at $7.25 an hour for the past 12 years, despite years of debate over a raise to $15 per hour and a recent focus in Congress on increasing wages. Even if that increase was implemented, it is no longer enough to support the average American family. A new report from USA Facts shows that single-earned households making $15 an hour would take 2 years working every weekday to make what the average family spends annually. The article you're about to hear has been written by Braden Waddle, a journalist writing for US News and World Report. The piece is titled, Report, $15 Hourly Wage Isn't Livable Anywhere in the United States. The federal minimum wage has remained at $7.25 an hour for the past 12 years, despite years of debate over a raise to $15 per hour and a recent focus in Congress on increasing wages. Even if that increase was implemented, it is no longer enough to support the average American family. A new report from USA Facts shows that single-earner households making $15 an hour would take 2 years working every weekday to make what the average family spends annually. The analysis focuses on the middle 20% of income earners and compares a $15 an hour wage to the average family's expenses, such as healthcare, food, and housing, using the data compiled from the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, the Bureau of Labor, and the Census Bureau from 2018, the most recent year with full data. Among those U.S. households, 71% rely primarily on a single earner for the family. Although average family expenses differ from state to state, the data shows that no family relying on a single $15 hourly income could afford average annual expenses anywhere in the United States. In Mississippi, the state with the lowest average family expenses, it would take 72 full work weeks at $15 an hour to cover expenses, and the state's current minimum wage is only $7.25 an hour. In Washington, D.C., with the highest average family spending, it would take more than 2.5 years. Only 9 states and Washington, D.C. have or are in the process of implementing a $15 per hour minimum wage, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Even if a $15 federal minimum wage was signed into law, American families relying on a single minimum wage earner would only bring in about half the money needed to cover average basic expenses each year. Although many states are on track to increase their minimum wages to between $10 to $13 an hour, basic necessities such as rent on a 2-bedroom apartment would require an hourly take-home pay of $24.90 per hour just to be affordable. President Joe Biden included an increase to the minimum wage in an early version of the American Rescue Plan Act, but it was removed from the final text. In an executive order in April, President Biden required federal contractors to pay their employees $15 per hour by March 2022. The United States says federal minimum wage has been $7.25 per hour since 2009. Many states implement higher minimum wages, and several are scheduled to increase theirs to $15 per hour in the next 5 years. Still, a renter in the United States would need to earn $20.40 per hour on average to afford a modest one-bedroom rental home in 2021, according to this year's edition of the National Low Income Housing Coalition's Out of Reach report. That figure increases to $24.90 per hour for a standard two-bedroom rental unit, the report says. And as the nation navigates a bumpy economic recovery in the fallout from the coronavirus pandemic, experts say the job losses brought about by the coronavirus and public health emergency disproportionately impacted workers who could least afford a blow to their incomes. This pandemic was an economic catastrophe for low-wage workers and people of color, Dan Threet, a research analyst at the National Low Income Housing Coalition, told U.S. News & World Report. Dan Threet says many low-wage workers are housing cost-burdened, meaning they're unable to spend less than 30% or in some cases 50% of their earnings on rent. When you're housing cost-burdened, you're not able to save for unexpected emergencies, he said. A shutdown or furlough can have reverberating effects and can be indicative of how those low-wage workers were much more likely to fall into a precarious situation. West Virginia and Arkansas rank lowest among U.S. states for housing costs, with average benchmark housing wages of $14.83 and $14.60 per hour, respectively. Still, with hourly minimum wages of $8.75 in West Virginia and $11 per hour in Arkansas as of 1st of July 2021, the estimate is that it would take 68 hours per week of minimum wage work in West Virginia and 53 hours of weekly minimum wage work in Arkansas to afford a standard two-bedroom rental home. California, Hawaii, and Massachusetts have the most prohibitive housing wages for a two-bedroom apartment, $39.03, $37.69, and $36.24 per hour, respectively, according to the report. Next are New York, the District of Columbia, and New Jersey, followed by Washington, Maryland, Colorado, and Connecticut to complete the top 10.
Africa Today.
"1960 may sound like a far cry back in time, but to victims of nuclear testing, the past is the present. Physical damage is a constant reminder of what happened. The victim was Algeria, and the perpetrator its colonial master of the time, France. So far, Algeria has finally managed to secure a quasi-apology from France. To hear how much more it can expect of the West European Mediterranean state, stay tuned with Africa Today. France covering up Algeria crimes. Algeria has made a national memory file to keep its suffering on record as an open case that can demand compensation. It will make no compromise on settling its issue of national memory with France, said its president, Tebboune. He adopts a positive diplomatic tone in his interview with a French reporter, however.
I think he was very receptive. really understood the request by Algeria. It's a necessity for us. I've said this several times. For that matter, we just established a special television channel, a remembrance channel, a memorial channel. We have a memorial day. He himself, President Macron, was courageous enough to say what others have not said. President Macron said he was the first to say that colonization was almost a crime against humanity.
The crimes are older than nuclear ones, as they were committed throughout the French colonial era of 1830 to 1962. France made a small gesture of goodwill by returning 24 skulls of Algerian resistance fighters from 170 years ago. They had been taken to France as souvenirs by French officers and were now returned from display to be buried in Algiers on Sunday, 18th of July. But reconciliation is incomplete, as France even refuses to hand over its maps of nuclear tests in Algeria so that the Arab African state can decontaminate affected areas. Never mind compensation, just clean up the mess, so to speak. Edward Corrigan is an international human rights lawyer joining us on Skype from London. Press TV asked him, around 5 million Algerians are estimated to have been killed by the French colonial authorities. France has found it less than easy to give Algeria a full apology even over crimes against its people. What's the reason for this intransigence?
Macron has refused outright to apologize for the France's history. And it's probably because they're concerned about, the international embarrassment and admitting that they were guilty of horrific crimes, of war crimes. But it's, a double standard where the winners are Western powers don't want to subject themselves to international law and other law that would apply to them, and they don't want to look at the dark side of their own history. You know, the United States has never compensated Vietnam for the terrible things that they did, and I think it took them years before they admitted that there was American soldiers who were exposed to Agent Orange were also eligible for some sort of help from the American government.
It's a job we've done before in our history, and I believe we can do it again.
The Sahara Desert near Reggane, about 700 miles southwest of Algiers. The site chosen for France's first A-bomb test. The atomic device was exploded on top of a metal pylon 350 feet high. The film record has been heavily censored by the French authorities, but this picture is impressive evidence of the bomb.
It was on the 13th of February 1960, just past 7 a.m., when France tested its first nuclear bomb named Jebois Bleu over Reggane, a small town in the middle of the desert. At the time, the French authorities explained that the tests were being conducted in uninhabited and deserted areas. However, at least 20,000 people were living at the sites, which still to this day have to be fully decontaminated. The explosion was four times the power of the Hiroshima bomb.
All precautions were taken so that neither the populations close to nor the populations distant from the site of the explosion were exposed to any danger.
This French veteran served in Algeria. If he looks okay, it's because of extensive plastic surgery. Gerard Delac is a Jebois Bleu victim. But he is one of the first few to have received some compensation by the French state after years of tireless efforts, largely led by the Association of Veterans of Nuclear Tests. Algeria's final expectation is still both decontamination and compensation to victims, although many will already have died from the progressive effect of contamination along the way. However, Tebboune seems to be allowing the French baby steps towards the goal.
It would provide for an appeasement, calm the climate, make things more serene for our economic relations, cultural relations, for good neighborly relations. After all, there are 6 million Algerians that live in France that can make a contribution there and a contribution here.
President Tebboune said in May that relations with France will not be upgraded without taking into account history and addressing the colonial memory issue. Do you think France will give in to Algerian pressure?
Unfortunately, I don't think so, because Algeria is, you know, not in a position to pressure France. It would have to be because of public opinion, or, you know, France developing a colony, a conscience to, to sort of show shame over what they did during the colonial period. So it is unlikely that France will do that.
It wasn't an isolated incident. Between 1960 and 1966, France conducted several nuclear tests in the Algerian desert, 4 on the ground and 13 underground. As Algeria celebrated its 59th anniversary of independence from France in July all these decades later, its Minister of Mujahideen and Rightholders of Algeria, France, Zitouni, had to mention incensed that France refuses to hand over a map of places where nuclear explosions took place in the Algerian desert when Algeria had requested them in April. Algeria won its independence on the 5th of July, 1962. Why would France be refusing to hand over the maps? Is it covering up for its illegal activities?
I think maybe some Frenchmen are also still angry and bitter that that France left Algeria, and they wanted to make it part of France. There was a large settler population that was sent from France to Algeria to try to, to turn it into like an appendage of France itself. So yes, I think they are trying to cover up illegal activity, and of course the testing of nuclear weapons, it would be prohibited under international law, especially if it's in a territory that's not yours, like a colony. And quite frankly, it's also very dangerous because there's lots of people living in Algeria, and it's even close to France, actually. There must have been nuclear fallout and stuff that would have affected even, neighboring countries in Africa, and possibly even France. It's not that far across the Mediterranean. If the wind changes direction, it's going to blow nuclear fallout into France itself.
More than 60 years after France's first atomic explosion, a report from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, recommends that France answer and provide Algeria with assistance in cleaning up the relevant sites, because France had buried all radioactive waste in the sand, from planes to tanks. Yet worse, radioactive materials, that's vitrified sand and contaminated rocks and lava, were left out in the open, thereby exposing the population and environment to definite danger. Can Algeria rely on international laws to compel France to hand over the maps, clean up the testing sites, and compensate the victims of the nuclear tests?
Algeria could go to the International Court of Justice for a ruling on this. Offhand, I don't know if France is put itself to the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court, but they still could go and make a test case and have a lot of information brought forward, and of course it would publicly shame the French for what they did. But France does not want to give money back to its colonies. In fact, as I understand it, France is getting billions of dollars each year from its former colonies. And there's an interesting episode where the Haitians were made to pay $15 billion to France to compensate the slave owners that lost the slaves after the uprising in Haiti that won the freedom for the slaves. And France just refused to do that. And of course, that was one of the reasons why Aristide was overthrown by the French, the Americans, and even the Canadians were involved with that. So there's a clear double standard.
France's former president, François Hollande, did acknowledge the massacre of some 5 million Algerians for the first time during a visit to Algeria in 2012. France today claims to respect human rights, but its crimes in Algeria and its refusal to compensate victims of its atrocities and clean up the nuclear mess are indicators of total disregard for human rights by this European power. This is a clear case of double standards. What's your take?
Well, it's hypocritical of France. They only want to enforce human rights if it gives them a political weapon to use against their own enemies or opponents. For example, France is making a lot of complaints about you know, human rights violation or alleged human rights violations in Syria. But it's a political weapon that, you know, the Americans and the French and the British use against the world, where they have selective application of the law. If it's in their interest to support a human rights violator like Saudi Arabia, they do so. If they want to attack a country, they complain about human rights violations. Usually it takes a long time before a country will admit its criminal past. But in France, it's probably too recent, because, you know, France got kicked out in the early 1960s from Algeria, but there are probably still people alive today that had served there. And there was a very strong, you know, movement in France to support, you know, the subjugation of Algeria. And it was de Gaulle then that took the French settlers out of Algeria and brought them back to France, which was, you know, an issue that was being very much complained about by the former French settlers and even elements in the French army.
Algeria is also seeking compensation for the 7,300 disabled victims of landmines planted during the war on the country's eastern and western borders. The country's labor minister, El Hashemi Jaboub, actually declared France our traditional and eternal enemy. Although, looking at the president today, Algeria seems to be taking a step back to give France the chance to do the right thing. If it does, the two countries can advance their diplomatic relations. That is a condition set by Algeria. South Sudan's 10 hopeless years.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio. It should have been a scene of jubilation. But July the 9th, 2021 was not the national day South Sudan would have expected 10 years ago when it separated from Sudan eventually by referendum. It is riddled with the aftermath of a civil war and war crimes and is living a humanitarian crisis so bad that a UNICEF chief called it a child rights crisis. Its president, Salva Kiir, did make a welcome promise on cessation anniversary 9th July.
On my part, I assure you that I will not return you back to war again. Let us all work together to recover the lost decade and put our country back to the path of development.
A pledge not to return the country to war because there has been a ceasefire since 2018. But the past foes have violated past truces, and progress on this latest revitalized deal has drifted, exacerbating mistrust between the pair. The pair being none other than the president and his deputy. In fact, they formed a political working twin set as a power-sharing deal to avoid rivalry and differences, which eventually did break out in 2013. The president is a former military commander from the Dinka ethnic group, and his deputy, Machar, is a rebel leader from the Nuer people. Abayomi Azikiwe is editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He has traveled extensively in Africa, conducting field research on political economy and history. He joins us from Detroit. Around just a year and a half after independence, this country was plunged into a brutal civil war at a cost of almost 400,000 lives, What was the reason behind this conflict?
The Vice President, Riek Machar, in late 2013 was accused of attempting to stage a coup against the president, and they moved to arrest some elements within the ruling party as well as the military. And this, of course, set off, as you mentioned, a long protracted struggle.
Observers have accused both the president and his deputy of playing a waiting game by delaying the full implementation of the peace accord, perhaps to evade accountability by, say, a war crimes court in partnership with the African Union. 2.27 to 4 million people were displaced by the war, and the country remains in the firm grip of political instability, economic malaise, and an acute hunger crisis. Sudan was the largest country on the African continent. Then a decade ago, it split in two to make for the world's youngest country, the Republic of South Sudan. After decades of fighting for independence, that day was a scene of jubilation, although you'd wonder why anyone would want to split his native land when complementary adjectives for a country are old, big, and rich. Well, South Sudan is rich in oil and other resources, and how many foreign lands of some clout wouldn't make a move for that? Under such circumstances, it's not difficult to tempt some domestic elements into not wanting to share their resources with the rest of the country. A UN panel of experts found evidence of well-established networks of arms suppliers in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, including from Israel, that are fueling the war in South Sudan. In a confidential report to the Security Council obtained by AFP, the panel described the arms deals as not recent and involving Israeli and Bulgarian firms. The Council has threatened to impose an arms embargo on South Sudan to try to end the fighting. Looking at reports that the Israeli regime violated UN sanctions and sold arms that have continued to fuel the Sudan conflict, what would you say are the Israeli interests in South Sudan's bloodshed?
This is done to undermine the struggle of the Palestinian people as well as the resistance forces throughout North Africa and West Asia. So their interest is to break up any type of solidarity with Palestine and other progressive resistance forces throughout the region, and also to exploit the oil resources and other resources in the Republic of South Sudan.
The international community has used the independence anniversary to urge South Sudan's leaders to do more to improve conditions for its under 12 million population. The journey from war to peace has been a long and difficult one, and there is still much to be done so that the people can exercise the democratic right they earned a decade ago. Nicholas Haysom said this. He's the head of the UN mission in South Sudan.
I think certainly for myself, I cannot think of anybody who deserves peace and prosperity more than the South Sudanese after decades of conflict. Durable peace and prosperity can only be made by the South Sudanese themselves. As we say in Africa, the doctor can't take medicine on behalf of the patient.
In the 10-year-old country, more than 8.5 million people face starvation. And 2.8 million children are out of school. That's the highest rate in the world. And it's due to limited access to education and high dropout rates. Schools closed due to corona have reopened, but of the additional 2 million pushed out because of corona closures, many have not returned. They must either work or study. Also, regarding the girls, most who dropped out are now mothers. Child marriage is a common problem in South Sudan. Rape and physical assault have also been reported among children.
When I was pregnant with my son, I got so sick that I had to go to Lir, a neighbouring village about 25 miles away, to get treatment. There was no means of transport, so I walked all the way and spent the night on the journey.
Such a waste to split your state basically because someone else wills you to do so, only to find yourself in a war in which forces are raping their own women. A wasted decade is how the South Sudan Council of Churches put it on the eve of Independence Day anniversary.
It was not only 2013, where our colleagues, my brother, were killed. Even during the struggle, my brothers, they were also killed.
Which other foreign countries might be interfering in this resource-rich country, and what are their objectives?
There's also the State of Israel, which had armed the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, and also has strong diplomatic relations between the capital of Juba and Tel Aviv. These are two main international forces that have, of course, been supportive of the independence and the partition of Sudan. So there was an explicit effort to split the Republic of Sudan, and it was done based upon the legacy of British colonialism inside the country.
Given all the sacrifice made by the nation, President Kiir said the priority of the revitalized transitional government of national unity is the full implementation of the peace agreement, with a focus on security and reforms to the economy, which depends 98% on revenues from crude oil exports.
To offer him the best treatment, which was amputation. But we are not here for not amputation. We are here to save lives, to save limbs.
What are the prospects of peace in Sudan? Will the warring parties eventually agree to implement the peace deal?
If you're speaking of the Republic of Sudan in the north, there is a reconciliation process that's underway. It's very tenuous at this point, and there are a lot of variables that are involved. Still, you have the U.S., you have the State of Israel, you have Saudi Arabia, you have the United Arab Emirates. They're all attempting to influence the internal affairs of both the Republic of Sudan in the north, as well as the Republic of South Sudan in the south. And regard to the peace agreement in the south, it largely depends upon the discipline and the willingness to resolve these differences among the followers of Riek Machar and Salva Kiir, who have the two largest political blocs in the Republic of South Sudan. But Israel, as well as the United States, has to provide both Sudan and South Sudan with the political space that it needs to resolve their own internal differences.
Tribalism has been a challenge, and that's why the national dialogue has been initiated, said General Kwong, the spokesman for the South Sudanese Army. We now have become peacemakers in the region as we have mediated between the North and different rebel groups and the Sudanese government. Perhaps we'll know by our next show how they panned out for Juba, the South Sudan capital. Do join us again each week at the same times to see where the story led or to see what's new in Africa.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BADR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.